Welcome to Apostrophe Cast. In The Cruelest Month, we bring you Porchista Kapoor. The names of her characters are as old as history. And in these selections from her novel, she paradoxically collapses time and space in the experience of one universal family that could only exist in America today. Please enjoy Porchista Kapoor reading from Suns and Other Flammable Objects.
This is Porchista Kapoor, and I'm reading from my debut novel, Suns and Other Flammable Objects. All you have to know is the protagonist's name is Xerxes Adam, and his dad's name is Darius Adam, and his mother's name is Lala. The novel is about a father and son who have a sort of traumatic split, and it only gets exacerbated by 9/11 and the aftermath. They're Iranian. The son is Iranian-American. And this scene begins on... Well, it ends up in the morning of 9/11 when Xerxes realizes that he actually has to call his parents in California. He's in New York. And let them know that he is okay. And communicate with them again after about 6 months or so of no communication whatsoever. Almost exactly 8 months after his father left him in New York, Xerxes Adam was awoken to the hottest summer day of the year by the invasion of a rather unwelcome mental slideshow, visions of that distant prime creator, his mother. Maybe he dreamed of her all night, every night even, who knew? He hoped not. He hoped it was just his conscience in calculation mode, sending the alarm that it was time, Xerxes, time, your mother is waiting. His mother had now left what he estimated must be 100-and-something messages in 30-something weeks. The first third had been desperate and urgent and worried. "Please, Xerxes," she would say, adding, "my son," in a shaky voice that would make him feel as if his entrails were melting. The second third, angry, annoyed, acerbic, trickling eventually to a just-pissed snippiness. "And who are you mad at exactly?" she would snap. The third third, cheery, oblivious, delusional, often delivered in the form of 5-minute-plus-long diary entry-like recordings that chronicled her day, just disjointed spewings of whatever was on her mind at the moment, only at the end perhaps tagging on, "Maybe you will call," or, "This is your mother, wondering how you are, but not wondering too hard, bye-bye." Or, like the last one, "Here's to you being all okay or whatever, chaproche." It was the type of good night that you'd leave a stranger. She would slam the phone down and turn off the lights. At some point, she had decided that calling at her bedtime would be best. They were 3 hours deeper into the night, and so he'd certainly be in at 1 in the morning, maybe 2, hell, 3, until midnight her time, and she'd give up and force herself to sleep. But not without giving the possibly pretend sleeping mass of husband next to her a sharp nudge and lecture. "This is getting crazy, Darius," she would hiss into the darkness. "What the hell did you do to him? He's our son. This is something you did. Now you get him back." "Here's your son, too, sorry to tell you. You try for once. You call him and don't waste it. Apologize. Lie, even. I don't care. Just bring him back to life." He'd mumble incoherently and toss and turn as if to signify some grand struggle. "I'm telling you," she would continue, "some other parents would call the police. How do we know he isn't, you know?" Xerxes wondered how she would possibly know if he was dead. She wouldn't. This was one thing about New York he realized immediately, that to die in this city was to die. The end, click, exit, human. No one would gather, no one would fight it or interfere, no one would even notice, no one was even looking. And if someone found you, well, fine, you were just another of many who died in the city that daily. Mysterious, natural, unsolved, homicidal, suicidal, whatever. You were a number, and if you didn't like that, you could leave. He did not want to leave. These were sacrifices worth making for the city, he had decided long ago. But it did alarm him that perhaps she'd resigned herself to thinking the worst in this third stage of messages. Perhaps she did assume he was dead, and perhaps she noticed any clues to the contrary, a changed message greeting at best, a simple surprises, grains of evidence for an alternate universe she'd once fought for but eventually tired of. Maybe his mother had done what no other mother in the history of the domestic matriarchy had done in regard to her offspring. Maybe she had abandoned hope. This barely conscious reflection of his two-thirds of a year's worth of inhumanity, combined with the sickly stickiness of a peculiarly oppressive 9 a.m. heat, jolted him fully awake, as if from a falling dream. Of all people, why had he shed his mother from his life? He remembered being a child and being mad at her so much more often than him. because it was she who was constantly stepping into his world, combing and gelling his hair when all the boys wore it messy, wiping his face, fiddling with his shirt, tying his shoes for him, always hollering annoying reminders as he was on his way out, always checking on him at his friends' houses, always tucking him in with embarrassing, often untrue admonitions or reminders. You are growing up. You need to think about smelling good now that you are growing up, showering regularly to begin with, because I am about to vomit and I am your mother. Or, the most dreaded, imagine yourself in the future and think, would my silly behavior today get me there? What would a future wife think now? Once in a while, in a rage, what would be on his constant repeat loop in his head would want to leak out. In his head, the answer to everything, everyone annoying and adult, was the sinister kitty staple, I wish you would die. Once, to Xerxes' own adult embarrassment, he remembered being pushed to say it out loud, though at best in a weak whisper. What did you say? She'd snap furiously. I wish you... He had paused. Sure, he could see a glimmer of tears in her eyes, although in retrospect, he thought any human's eyes, naturally slimy and liquidy, could look tearful if guilt steered you in that direction. And he had rephrased, I wish you guys would die. Psychologically, it was better for him, but its true genius was in being better for her as well. You guys became the great equalizer. It was suddenly more like, I wish the whole institution of you, parenthood, would die, not you personally. All she had done was shake her head. She had still tucked him in. And so he wondered now, too many years later, how at 6 a.m. their time and their other heat, their dry, dull warmth of West Coast versus his merciless, wet, dirty, big city tropical wave, how he could reach her and soften his blow. He had basically, in his silence and his refusal to reach out, said to them, I wish I was dead to you. And he'd gotten what he wanted. He might as well be. Plus, this time, his I wish I was dead to you meant to her, not to you guys. For him, he had a whole other style of I wish I was dead. It was more like, I wish I was dead so as not to have ever been ever existed by you. So when he finally did it that morning, did the dreaded dialing of a number he grew up with, which still seemed so natural with the automatic sequencing of otherwise illogical numbers that he had worked so hard to render unnatural, he didn't even consider that she might not be the one to pick up. As life goes, it had to be him, his father, with his usual gruff, reluctant, hello, that put the emphasis on hell, which he probably was conscious of and probably found funny or else apt. There is no God, Xerxes sighed. Xerxes slammed the phone down, shoving it deep into a drawer as if to pretend it had never happened. He closed his eyes and buried the day back into his pillow. 3 weeks later, a day after the first 1/3 of September 2001, he finally called, when life finally gave him a push to put whatever pettiness between him and that number aside, if only for a day, when he knew risking him could no longer be an issue, that he had to more than ever announce himself as living, as one of the many who that day felt like a few, who had lived through it so far at least, and through the few dial tones, he said to himself over and over, there is a God, there is a God, oh please let there be a God. And suddenly, there she was, answering without even a hello, just that mystical, all-knowing mother's, Xerxes? And the first thing he could think to say was the only thing that he knew true in that surreal hell of a day. Mother, he declared breathlessly, I am alive. Darius was, of course, at her side, just barely making out the sounds through the receiver at his wife's ear. His son's voice was that usually tinny, high chipmunk garble that phones rendered voices. It could be anyone's voice, he thought. It all sounds the same, except that is my son. His son, calling from the heart of a danger he could not comprehend at the moment. He drowned him out and drowned out his wife's overcompensating awkward coos and exclamations and turned the news louder until they both disappeared into the unrelenting dissonance of disaster. On the television, they crumbled over and over, two tall, perhaps too proud totems of a city, two towers erected to be each other's image, indistinguishable, somber doubles each dying the same death, neither intolerable when it came to the supposedly inevitable. Over and over, it replayed. One went down, the other stood solo. Fast forward to new clips. The other goes down just as the first, and nothing. Where his son was, it was sunny. It was also sunny where he was. He squinted out the window and imagined the entire sky over America smiling heartlessly. He imagined in his homeland it was almost dark. He thought there was at best only a moon over Iran, and he thought how nice that was. He closed his eyes, and gone were the repeating images on the television, and gone was that blinding brightness, and he let the just-so-dark wall of his eyelid melt into the image of the twilight Tehran sky. It was time to go home. And then I'll read a second short section from a little bit further from the chapter Nights that deals a lot with both father and son's separate but equal insomnia episodes. They both go through a phase of very troubled sleep right after September 11th, but which actually has a lot more to do with their fragmented relationship. So Nights is kind of devoted to dreams. The only thing you really need to know here is that Xerxes, as a child, was always obsessed with Barbara Eden. Xerxes couldn't recall experiencing a full night's sleep in many, many, many months. Of course, he knew he had to have slept somewhere here and there, some tidbits of snooze, just enough to keep the body and head going at a bare minimum, but he couldn't remember a normal night of it. Slowly, over the course of a few seasons, he had felt himself fade more and more into a constantly living phantom, an uninterrupted consciousness that existed at a consistent downgraded vibrancy, lit always, but always dimly lit. The lack of sleep, while it increased the quantity of his active life, if it could be called that, those wasted, frustrated hours staring at the clock and praying to the thin air for even a few minutes' worth of active minded shutdown, sucked away at the quality of his life. He was always living, but day after day the living grew shittier and shittier. He never felt the cliché more poignantly, "Every day we are dying." That was it. Without the intermission of sleep, all he had to face was that his heartbeats were running, but running out as well. It wasn't until late September 2001 that he gave up even trying. He simply stopped sleeping for days at a time, not even getting into horizontal position, not even offing lights, not even trying to kid it. He didn't want to sleep suddenly. Who knew what could happen to the world if he looked away too long? And as it goes, it was in this stage of his insomnia that his body and mind, closer to a sort of collapse than even Xerxes was aware of, snapped into emergency mode and began delivering spontaneous bursts of sleep here and there, if just to save him. Xerxes called it passing out, blacking out, fainting, collapsing. I think I was in a coma, officer. What time is it? They were especially strange because the moment the world would go blank to him, boom, he'd find himself in that other world, suddenly dream life. His eyes would drop like a curtain on his real world and snap. Math class, third grade, Mrs. Lynch, but with students he doesn't recognize. He has to pee. Or he'd find himself somewhere else, beyond questioning, beyond fighting out of. Arizona, or Mars, is it? Red Rock, Lala arguing, a bird-like dog or dog-like bird appears. She screams. He'd be beamed into it in a way that almost implied he always existed in that parallel universe. The motion picture, Basic Instinct, Malawi, an animated Eden Gardens, the White House movie room. But he had just failed to tune into it. "And that's the way it goes, you know," she was saying, when there he was again, suddenly before a grinning blonde in a tight, small, sequined pink vest, sheer flower petal pants, perfect ponytail, pretty pink grin. "Barbara Eden?" She rolls her eyes at him and in a lowered voice gently scolds. "Please, Jeannie." "Right," he says. "Right, jeez, right." He looks around. They're in a palace of sorts, a palace marble-like, overdone, overprecious, somewhat like a palace constructed out of wedding cake. There's intricate white tiling on all walls, old Arabic style, all labyrinthine latticework. Somewhere he can hear the trickling of an indoor fountain. It's beautiful and ridiculous, like being in a museum's historical recreation window. As it goes, he doesn't question it. Before he can process it all, she pushes him down to the floor. She bites at his collar. Oh, wow, a dress shirt, he notices on himself. He's actually wearing a dress shirt, and a nice one. She breathes hard on his neck, her hands wandering hungrily, her giggles everywhere astray, when suddenly there is a minor wrinkle in the dream and he feels like it needs to move on. Something is about to strike. Shit, he thinks. Just give me this episode. Let's just go with this for a second. This was greater than this boyhood dream and all his fantasies. Jeannie, hell, he never even imagined fucking her. And so the dream maintains itself. Tentative feeling, however, but he doesn't mind. He helps her unbutton his shirt, even unzips his own pants, tries to get to her clothes, but like the magic that is her vocation, whoosh, her clothes are already gone. She's already her hairless, bare, bulb doll self. Could we even do this? She's not a human after all. She's like a sprite or something, no? And she's pressing herself up against him and saying things he can't understand into his bare chest, when of course he thinks the thing that has to end all dreams at the wrong point is going to come. Oh, shit, it's coming. He can feel it. Worse than waking up. A bad plot twist. They're being watched. They've been fucking behind a veil, a white gauzy veil that has now been lifted by several rough male hands. All he can see is their pupils, angry. Get away from her, he hears one voice. You have violated us, says another. You will be punished. Exit, Genie. Before he can fully register this truly grotesque rearranging of a perfectly good dreamscape, there he is with half a dozen guards around him, big men, dirty, burly, swarthy thugs who are taking him down into a chamber. They have to walk down several spiral staircases into a basement of sorts, except when they get down there, it's actually a cave. A dirt cave lit by torches with nothing inside but more guards. What's happening? His voice is echoing, his annoyance with this world of men and dirt and more men replacing the world of his dream girl and sex inside a wedding cake casa, now eclipsed by sheer fear. God is going to decide, Xerxes, is the only answer he gets from the chorus of men. Finally, he hears the footsteps down the stairs, and there are two more guards, and suddenly there he is, the he they've all been waiting for. He's wearing a turban and a tunic, all in gray or possibly a white that's just dirty. He has a beard. He is smiling. The turban man walking towards him says, "In the dream you come to us. In reality we came to you. Came to your country. You remember." He doesn't have too much room to play with, Xerxes notices. The cave is small and the man is now getting closer than, say, two men in an office cubicle would ever get. "To your city," he says. You will never forget." He is so close they could shake hands, Xerxes registers, noting that he could feel the man's very body heat. He's hot like a heat lamp, like an August beach day, hell, like an unfiltered sun. Xerxes actually finds himself worrying he could get burned. "Just down your street, did we not?" Thankfully, he stops just short of his face. Xerxes, as much as he tries to memorize every line, every feature, every distinguishing facial characteristic, is destined to wake in a few moments, remembering nothing of this man's mug. The man will appear in a turban and tunic and even beard, but completely and utterly faceless. "Were those your people?" the man asks. Some would say, "I am your people." Of course, he would have his theories as to who the man was. He would understand why at that very moment another heat would be suddenly coming from within his own self, canceling out the man's threatening bodily air of apocalypse, why suddenly deep within him he'd feel a boil, the rage of several thousand men, enough for an army, men and women, all strangers of, yes, his city, his country, if it was his country. In one of his heads, twisted dream life or simple thoughtscape, he'd declare, "I am not a fool. I know who you are, where you come from at the very least, and it's close to me, close to where I come from, yes, but aside from that, we have nothing in common, and you are not going to destroy me. You have no chance in this. I can turn you back in a second, poof, and then none of this, none of it. It's just a, oh, fuck it." Just as he was vanishing away and Xerxes was rubbing his eyes furiously to get to reality and face the all-absolving day, he heard the faceless turban man's last words, residual dream afterthought, leaking paranormally into the virgin daylight of real waking life. He says, "But Xerxes, it happened." And that is everything. Thank you. Okay. Bye.
Please join us on April 23rd for Cecily Parks.